In the age of climate change, where extreme weather conditions are becoming increasingly common and increasingly lethal, how do we remember the victims? At the University of Wisconsin-Madison, historian Richard C. Keller offers some answers to this question through his study of the 2003 heat wave in France. This was the worst natural disaster in the country's history, claiming some 15,000 lives. Despite the public outrage triggered by the shocking death toll, Keller argues that thousands of deaths were forgotten because they didn't match the typical victim profile. Years after the event, Keller identified an exculpatory narrative shared by many who recalled the disaster. It was a self-serving, guilt-reducing narrative that claimed that many of the deaths were unavoidable, even inevitable, because of the poor life choices made by the victims. Forgotten in this narrative was the deadly nature of housing for the poor in France's capital, and a long history of animosity towards many of the victims who found themselves relegated to a fatal isolation. A conversation with Richard C. Keller about his book, Fatal Isolation, The Devastating Paris Heat Wave of 2003, in this episode of Realms of Memory. Rick, welcome to Realms of Memory.
Thanks so much for having me.
First, let me say what a pleasure it was to read your book. I mean, my own background is French history, and I've been doing this for 3 years now. I don't have a single episode on France. I've been looking around, and I was so happy to find your book. Plus, I really wanted to do more on the environment. So your book really brings everything together for me that I was searching for. And as you know, I was there that summer, and 2003, that heat wave that killed thousands of people. And you mentioned this was the worst natural disaster in French history. And one of the things that caught me by surprise reading your book is the extent to which this caught the government authorities by surprise. It caught health experts, and it even caught the media by surprise. So they were late to recognizing. They maybe you mentioned at one point they recognized it, but they didn't really understand the full impact of what was going on. So why was this something that took so long for government officials, for the media, for health experts to realize what was happening?
Yeah, excellent question, Rick. Thanks so much. So essentially, this was really a perfect storm. As you know, as a French historian, or as I'm guessing you know, in August, much of the country really shuts down when everyone goes on vacation. And this was a moment when essentially French government officials were all out of the office. Hospital staff were largely out of the office. This was a situation where so many people were essentially on vacation that you had a kind of B or C team in place in any critical offices. And so communications essentially had broken down. So one of the really fascinating things about doing contemporary history is the amount of information that you can find in this kind of novel archive. So I was able to track down essentially every email that went in and out of the Ministry of Health during the disaster. And it was startling to me to see just how much miscommunication was happening. Essentially, you'd have people writing someone, they would get an out-of-office message, it would get transferred to someone else. They would then be on their way out of the office the next day. So you had a whole chain of command that essentially broke down. So any warning system, any efforts to issue alerts really broke down in that same process. It was really only on August 10th, about 8 days into extreme heat, that the head of the Parisian Emergency Physicians Union, a guy named Patrick Pelloux, essentially called attention to the fact that he had dozens and dozens of people dying in his ward alone, and issued an alert that this was essentially a national problem.
He seems to be the guy who's really sounding the alarm first, bringing it to the attention of the media. But you mentioned he's a guy who people kind of dismissed as he just exaggerates, he's sensationalizing. So even he really wasn't taken seriously at the beginning.
Yeah, he was taken seriously by the media. He had a really big spotlight on him, on, you know, national news channels and so on. But politicians essentially dismissed him as, you know, screaming hyperbole. And part of this had to do maybe with his track record in French politics. He was someone who was constantly shouting at politicians to increase funding for healthcare and so on, maybe rightly so. But he was someone who people already sort of rolled their eyes out a little bit. And so I think that in part, he wasn't taken seriously as a function.
So eventually there is this realization that this is a crisis of some significant proportions. And but you stress that when there's an effort to frame it on the part of the government in power, and it's a kind of center-right government in power at the time, and when the left tries to frame it, the opposition, when the media tries to frame it, they do so in kind of a simplistic way. And they understand it in a partial, incomplete way. And this has lasting repercussions for how people remember this event and also how the government reacts to it later on. So what are these simplified narratives and explanations and stories of what's happening?
Yeah, sure. So one of the easiest ways to frame this by the center-right government, which was already campaigning on an excess of entitlements in France, was to say that this was the function of selfishness and a collapse in family solidarity, a collapse in family values, and an excess of entitlement. So essentially what the government does to frame the problem, and the media seizes on this immediately, is this notion that you have middle-class France that leaves on vacation and ignores its older and less healthy relatives to die in the heat. And it was a sort of pure selfishness of people who, you know, needed their beach vacation, their paid beach vacation, and essentially ignored more vulnerable populations in the process. And as it turns out, that's really not at all what happened. It's a very easy story to tell. It's a great story to use to campaign on this idea of entitlement and selfishness and a need for the government to pare back some of those benefits. But really, it's not the case at all. As it turns out, most of the people who died essentially had no relatives. They were largely living alone, living in, as the title indicates, a kind of fatal isolation. And indeed, living alone and having very few social connections, as it turns out, is the most significant risk factor for dying during an extreme heat event.
So the center-right government frames this as a kind of selfish people who would rather go on their vacation than take care of their loved ones. But the opposition also has its own take. I mean, it's looking to take advantage of the opportunity. You mentioned this. This is more of a chance for each. Well, for the government to deflect, for the opposition to score points, but also health experts are coming up with their own kind of limited take on it.
Absolutely. So the left's framing of the same crisis is basically that there's been a collapse in government funding, that the center-right government has been essentially paring back the welfare state too much, and that rather than a crisis of individual solidarity with more vulnerable populations, the way in which the center right is trying to frame it, the left is essentially saying that no, the state needs to be doing more. And there are way too many cracks in the social safety net as a function of austerity programs. So that's, you know, again, a highly simplified sort of narrative that the left is putting out. As far as the consensus of health experts, there, you know, and this is, I think, not the fault of epidemiologists or demographers. Public health money is limited. And so one of the main things that epidemiologists tend to do is they try to aggregate. They look for the highest probabilities of what creates vulnerability. And so the epidemiological conclusion to what happened during the event was essentially that an aging population in a moment of a changing climate and extreme heat faced extraordinary vulnerability. And so essentially the image that emerges from all three of these narratives of the kind of person who is extremely vulnerable is that of an older, and when I say older, you know, basically like an 80-year-old woman who lives in the city in significant poverty. And that's essentially the image of vulnerability. And it's not wrong, right? Some probably 70% of those who died fit into that mold. But the problem with a kind of simplistic narrative of vulnerability, again, that comes from all of those sides, is that it misses a large chunk of the vulnerable population. It misses younger people who may have pre-existing health conditions. It misses unhoused people. It misses people who have other kinds of disabilities that might make them vulnerable to extreme heat as a function of social isolation and health-related social isolation at that.
And this is not an insignificant number of people who are missed. I mean, the numbers really add up. So, and I know I know you framed this in terms of incidents or disasters that have happened, attacks that have happened in the U.S. So on what scale is it the people who are left out of the story?
Sure. So 80% of those who die are age 75 or older, and most of those are women. So you can see why, if you're looking in the aggregate, that looks like the basic risk profile is of an older woman. And most of them, again, were living in urban environments and were living in poverty. But that leaves out, and this is a crisis of, 15,000 deaths within basically 2 weeks. So that leaves out 3,000 people. That leaves out essentially the number of people who died in the United States on September 11th, 2001. Which is a significant mortality event in its own right. And, I think a number that's that significant is something we need to really pay attention to. So one of the things I think we need to do as humanists who are, investigating these kinds of problems that are typically in the realm of scientists, right, natural, physical, and biological scientists, is to think about what are the kind of common factors that these 3,000 people had with the 12,000 others that are kind of unifying signifiers of vulnerability.
Okay, so this is a different kind of forgetting, I think, than has come up in any other episode. I mean, I just think of the Soviet Union, the blind spots of history. There are blind spots here, but it's not really, I don't know whether you can say it's not really intentional. Maybe on the part of the government, the deflection is intentional, but it's not the health experts. It's not like they're trying to leave out. You stress a lot of this has to do with just how they count, how they aggregate. They have these methods that are very useful, and they allow them to target all kinds of risk factors and identify populations that were most affected, but they just leave out thousands of people.
Absolutely. And I think it's an inherent flaw that's built into the way in which epidemiologists look at risk, right? I think one of the best parallels I can come up with as a historian of medicine and public health is to look at the early AIDS crisis in the United States, right? And if this metaphor is too far flung, then please, edit it out in post, I guess. But effectively, if you look at HIV/AIDS in the United States in the 1980s, it's a crisis primarily of gay men. Right, there are 13 cases among men for every single case that you have in a woman. And so if you look at that kind of ratio, it's primarily men who have sex with men and injecting drug users who are suffering from this novel disease. And so it kind of makes sense for, public awareness campaigns, for physicians, for everybody to kind of focus on that population that is primarily at risk. Right. And just because a population is primarily at risk doesn't mean that there aren't other populations at risk. So it made sense in the 1980s for physicians and epidemiologists to look at HIV as a crisis of gay men's health. Right. Fast forward a few years, as a function of those kinds of epidemiological blinders, where you see this relentless focus on men and primarily men who have sex with men as the primary victims of the disease, what you have is a growing crisis among women, among Black women in particular, where AIDS becomes the leading cause of death for Black women ages 15 to 49 by the middle of the 1990s. So essentially, you're ignoring a whole population at risk by focusing on the population that's primarily at risk. And the same thing really happens as a function of these heat waves, right? Where there's a relentless focus on the population that's primarily at risk, which is older, poor urban dwellers, and primarily women there, and a complete kind of blind spot and a kind of forgetting, as you indicated earlier, of other populations that are significantly at risk and in significant numbers.
Okay. Now, my impression is part of what shifts and broadens the narrative, maybe narrows it. At the same time, it seems like it picks up on a theme that was in the media, but it causes the media to focus more on a particular group of people. There's an article that comes out in a Paris newspaper, and it focuses on a particular group of victims of the heat wave, and it creates a big stir and a new narrative line that kind of shifts the focus of how people are thinking and talking about it. Could you unpack that a bit?
Sure. So as I indicated earlier, it's on, I believe, August 10th that Patrick Pelou, the head of the Emergency Physician Union, calls attention to this growing crisis of morbidity and mortality linked to extreme heat. By August 14th or so, the government has sprung into action, and there is a growing awareness of a mass mortality crisis. There are images circulating in the media of refrigerated trucks storing bodies. There is increasing awareness that, you know, there is just that there are bodies piling up in a way that's become unmanageable, in particular in the capital city. But by September 1st, there's another kind of haunting realization that emerges through the media, and largely through this article that's run in Le Parisien, and its national its national counterpart Aujourd'hui en France, which is that there are hundreds of bodies that have remained unclaimed in morgues around the country. Essentially, these are people who died alone, and they died in such isolation that no one has come to claim the bodies. And this prompts a kind of hand-wringing and a kind of panic, a sort of moral panic in France, that how can we, the country that essentially invented the notion of human rights, a country that sees itself as a cradle of humanitarianism, a country that sees itself as the home of modern humanism, how is it that we can ignore the human rights of our population so profoundly that we have literally hundreds of people who have died so alone and in such total isolation that they have remained unclaimed by family, by friends, by anyone, essentially? There's a crisis of abandonment, or a realization of a kind of crisis of abandonment that emerges around the very beginning of September.
That was fascinating. I knew nothing about that cemetery. I had the TA cemetery right outside of Paris, kind of a pauper cemetery. You know, Paris is famous for cemeteries like Père Lachaise, where you go and you try to find, well, where is Jim Morrison buried? Where is Oscar Wilde? But this is not the cemetery people that tourists are going to go and visit. Could you talk about that particular cemetery?
Yeah, and I should be clear that it isn't entirely a pauper cemetery. It's essentially a normal cemetery where ordinary people get buried. But there is a section, basically four subsections of the cemetery. They're called les sectaires d'indigents, or essentially the poor section, the paupers section. And this is where people who die in public custody, whose bodies remain unclaimed by any family or friends. This is where bodies that the state is primarily responsible for wind up. And they wind up in these kind of reusable graves where there is a kind of sarcophagus that's mounted at ground level that has a kind of concrete cover. They have these really marvelous kind of lifts, essentially, that can remove the lid to replace a body as necessary. And so bodies of, for example, unhoused people or people who die in state custody, prisoners, essentially, or other people who remain unclaimed, wind up going to one of these graves where they're stored for 5 years in the event that someone does come forward to claim the body, which happens rarely, but it does happen. They're stored there for 5 years, and then the bodies are moved as necessary to make room for new bodies. And so it's the kind of cemetery that gets very little tourist traffic, as you indicated. But it is the kind of place where the vast majority of the cemetery is just a place where ordinary Parisians can find space to be buried.
And I don't know how much of the graphic detail the press got into, but that was also one of the things that struck me. You say, okay, people died of heat wave. Well, their bodies were discovered. But what you stress, part of the outrage, is how long it took and how gruesome it was. And the funeral workers were the people who were at the front lines. And you point out that they're handling a volume of dead that is just dwarfing anything that's come up to now, which is hard for us to think about after coming through the COVID crisis, where that just became nightly news. But they're worn down. And again, we're used to this kind of coverage of COVID, the health workers. I mean, just watching the French news today, they were talking about the emergency wards are still understaffed. There's still people who are waiting on beds in hallways for hours before they receive attention. But during that crisis, these funeral workers, they're bringing people from outside the region. They're dropping out. That just what they discover, what they have to deal with, what neighbors have to deal with is just really gruesome. Could you describe that a little bit? What does this actually entail when somebody dies during a heat wave and isn't discovered for days afterwards?
Yeah. And apologies in advance and a kind of content warning for some pretty graphic images that are going to come up here. So on any given day in any given August, about 38 people die in Paris, and their bodies are transported either from their home or from a hospital to a morgue in order to await processing. On the 3 days of August 11th, 12th, and 13th, 2003, the city of Paris transported 790 bodies. Okay, they should have transported about 120. So you can see that this is just an exponential increase in the number of dead that the city is handling at this point. So first of all, just the crisis of scale, right? And the amount of 24-hour labor that's going into the management of death is already a critical issue that's leading to just rapid burnout among funeral workers and those who are transporting these bodies from homes, hospitals, nursing homes, and so on to morgues. The other issue is the state in which these bodies are found. So I mentioned earlier that August is a significant vacation period in France. The city of Paris largely empties out. And so what happens is you have people who are left behind in apartment buildings where they're largely uninhabited, right? There might be a couple of other people who are in the residence. So you have people who are dying of extreme heat, and their dead body is simply lying on the floor or in the bed of an apartment in that extreme heat, decomposing rapidly. And so when people are coming home from their vacations, they are coming home and they're overwhelmed by a smell when they enter the apartment building. They have no idea what it is typically, but it's just a horrifying, just terrible, terrible odor. And so they'll call the police. The police will come and they'll discover that there's a dead body behind the door of the apartment from which that smell is emanating. Some people came home and discovered that someone had died in the apartment directly above them. The way they discovered this is that they come into their apartment and they find that it is covered with maggots, that there are body fluids that have drained through the floor onto their kitchen counter. The horrific level of what people are discovering when they come home to these terrible smells and these terrible discoveries. It's something that's largely unprecedented, right? Because this is happening all over the city. So the conditions in which these funeral workers are laboring are just utterly terrible. To the extent that you have funeral workers who are saying they would much rather deal with a suicide in the metro and cleaning up that kind of mess on the tracks than discovering one of these bodies that has been there for days or in some cases even weeks.
Okay. So the focus of your book is to look at I don't know, would you say the same segment of people who are featured in this, in the Parisienne article, to look at these forgotten and to try to get a better understanding of who they are. And you describe this as the history that you put together of these people, the field work you do, the neighbors that you talk to, the people who have businesses, who might know them. And you describe this as an anecdotal history, which makes it seem like there isn't much there. Can you explain what does anecdotal mean? How is there actually a lot there to discover?
Yeah, thank you for the question. So as a historian, right, I was looking for a way into this crisis, as a way to think about the sort of social dimensions of this crisis. This was something that was studied 6 ways to Sunday, right, by epidemiologists, demographers, other kinds of health officials. It was subject to an intense analysis by the Senate and by the National Assembly. And so, you know, trying to find something novel to say about it, something that remained largely unsaid about the crisis, was something that I was really kind of seeking to do, not just to find something novel, but also to think about a way to kind of humanize the crisis, because so much of the crisis was depicted in these kind of large aggregate numbers, where you had the creation of a typical risk profile that, you know, was largely accurate, but also left a large part of the story untold. So I read a very short book by a political scientist, I believe, named Vincent Collet, if I remember his name correctly, who had looked at the story of these forgotten populations and did a kind of really cursory look at, you know, who these people were and that kind of crisis of abandonment. And I thought, this is something that somebody needs to dig into a little bit more deeply, and found myself, you know, kind of positioned ideally to do that. So what I did was I went to the cemetery, collected the names of these people from the headstones, the names and dates of birth or death where they were available and printed on the headstones at the cemetery. And I initially looked in phone books from 2002 and before, which I found at the National Library. This is not a good way to identify people and to do field work. It leaves a lot of people undiscovered because some people don't have phones, some people are unlisted. And it also leads to a kind of crisis of duplication because people have the same name. And so, you know, there are 4 listings under the same name. And so which one is this person going to be? Then I discovered a better way to do this work, which was to write to the Bureau d'État Civil, the vital statistics offices that are in every arrondissement in Paris, and request what's called a death notice for each of these people. It's an acte de décès. This is not a death certificate. It doesn't contain any medical information about cause of death or anything like that, but it's purely a demographic document. It tells you the person's name, their date of birth, if known, their marital status, and most importantly, where they were when they died, what their address was and where they were when they died. Some people died in hospitals, some people die on the street, and so on. Not everybody dies in their home. What this gave me was a way into that story where I could go visit their addresses, speak to the concierge or gardienne of the building, essentially a kind of building caretaker, the people who collect the mail and distribute it. They hold packages for you. They sweep the staircases. They are really good kind of minders of the building, right? They know about the comings and goings of everyone who lives in the building. And they make, as a consequence, really remarkable ethnographic informants. Because they know the details of everyone who lives there. And so this was my initial kind of way in. And in some cases, buildings don't have a gardien or concierge, but there are neighbors who are in the building. There are shopkeepers in the neighborhood where people buy their baguettes or their groceries and so on. And so these were essentially my informants. And so what I would do is I would, you know, go to the building, speak to whoever I could find, and ask about the case of, you know, Monsieur X or Monsieur Y or Madame Z, right? In order to try to establish some of the details of these people's lives. And what I found overwhelmingly was that people spoke to me in what I call in chapter 2 of the book, anecdotes. They would tell little stories about the person. They would tell stories that almost invariably led directly to that person's death in isolation. So they would tell me these fragmentary histories about a person's social existence, or rather, I should say, their social isolation, that largely indicated that this was a product of that person's own making. So they would say, oh, so-and-so was a retired hairdresser, and she had a serious drinking problem. She had mental illness, and she pushed people away from her constantly. She had alienated herself from her family through her hostile behavior. She had alienated herself from neighbors through that same hostile behavior. And so what I would get were these sort of fragmentary stories that were incredibly far from any kind of comprehensive biography. But what they did was they were a sort of rhetoric that led directly to why that person was living in isolation. They were kind of exculpatory narratives that essentially exempted the person telling the story from any responsibility for that person's death, right? They were their misbehavior, their antisocial behavior existed on such a scale that they couldn't be helped, essentially. And this was, I think, a way in which people could come to terms with the fact that somebody died in their own building, and they died in conditions that were really kind of horrifying, if you think about it in any kind of detail.
So it really takes them, it gets them off the hook for having any kind of responsibility. So it's a kind of double forgetting that you have going on. On the one hand, you have the numbers that erase the victims, or at least erase thousands of them that don't fit the profile. You have the neighbors who say, well, these people didn't really die of the heat wave. Look at their lifestyle. Look at the choices they made, that they were, that their life course was headed towards that outcome.
And yeah, that's a great way of putting it.
It just did them in. That was the final incident.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it, right? That these were people who are already slated for death in one way or another. They're people you could expect to die. They're people you're not at all surprised to hear about dying. And the thing about heat waves, right, is that deaths during heat waves are almost invariably preventable deaths. Now, I'm not trying to blame the neighbors for this happening. I'm not trying to blame the concierge or gardien of the building for this happening. Maybe many of these deaths were inevitable, and maybe they were a function of people's antisocial behavior. So I'm not trying to pin the blame here, right? But I am really fascinated by this process by which people are almost assuming that they're being blamed, and therefore come up really inadvertently and unintentionally, perhaps, with these kinds of narratives that are essentially exculpatory.
And if they frame those lives, they frame them from the end, and everything else leads to that conclusion, inevitable conclusion.
That's exactly right.
So one of the things that you dig down on is, if you're trying to understand attitudes towards the forgotten, at least the elderly, that there's a history of hostility towards the elderly. And I got to admit, as someone who is thinking hard about, well, could France be a good third act destination for me? I was pretty depressed reading that part of your book. That was like a wet blanket thrown over my optimism about the culture. But one of your points is, this is a country that there's a long history of hostility towards the elderly, and it has to do with the demographics of France. It has to do with the history of bloodletting in World War I. So when you dug into a particular body of literature, what did you find out about how attitudes that you were trying to connect, attitudes in France toward the elderly, that might tie into some of what you picked up on in these anecdotal histories?
Sure. And I have to say that there are many stories, there are many histories of aging in France, right? And this is just one of them. So this is not a complete story at all. But there are certain perspectives on aging in France that are pretty hostile. And I would argue that they're a kind of counterpart to pronatalism, right? They are the other side of pronatalism. So if you think about all of the literature that's emerged on pronatalism from, for example, Mary Louise Roberts' Civilization Without Sexes, about this incredible emphasis, particularly in the interwar period, on promoting the birth rate, right, on replacing all of those soldiers who died and boosting the population in order to compete with what French critics see as a kind of remarkable fecundity that you see in Germany, right? And the threat of an increasing German population, what it poses for what may be a second mass conflict, in a remarkable kind of prescience, I guess. But there's a panic about the birth rate. And there's a panic that the population is aging. And these are sort of two sides of the same coin, right? So as the birth rate is collapsing, the population demographically is getting older. And as it gets older, in the case of many developed countries, many industrialized countries, in France, women tend to outlive men. So as the population ages, it also gets more feminine, right? And so this is a demographic curve that you can see pretty plainly. That as the population gets older, there are more women than men in those older age brackets. And for critics, and most of them are pronatalist critics, who want to boost the population, they want the population to be younger and more vital, there is a sense that this is a national catastrophe, that France is getting older and more feminine, and it's losing its vitality in the process. To the extent that demographers in the aftermath of the Second World War blame France's collapse in the face of a German onslaught and the occupation on national aging and femininity, that this is a very gendered argument and a very kind of ageist argument. And that kind of rhetoric can't help but take hold at some levels, where you see social critics, you see demographers, you see politicians arguing that there is a problem of aging in France, right? That there is a real kind of national crisis of aging. And that aging is placing overwhelming burdens on the social welfare system, that there aren't enough younger people who are working to support a large retired class of people who are living out their lives in a state of entitlement. And so that kind of rhetoric really takes hold. Now, that's not to argue that the social safety net isn't significant in France, right? It's much better than what we have in the United States. Retirees often do quite well in France. There are good data that suggest most first class rail fares are purchased by retirees as opposed to younger populations. In general, the condition of older people in France is actually pretty good. Right. So maybe don't rule out that third act destination. At the same time, there is also a sense that there's another kind of aging, right? There's the aging of people in their first flush of retirement who are, tanned, enjoying relaxation, enjoying their grandchildren and so on. But there's also another side of aging, which is that of aging in poverty, the aging of a pensioner who is living on a really, really modest fixed income, a person who never purchased property, maybe somebody who never got married in the first place, who is living out their life in a state of kind of anonymous poverty. And that is the kind of focus of a kind of extraordinary ageism that does, I think, run fairly rampant in French culture. Not that it doesn't run rampant in other places too, right? I just happen to look at it in France. I think the same kind of attitudes prevail in lots of industrialized countries. But it is, I think, a real thing. It's a sort of subcurrent, one kind of narrative about aging that helps the population and, in particular, politicians to look at the heat wave crisis as something that, maybe not such a big deal. What it did was it killed people who were maybe 6 months from dying anyway. There's a sort of trivialization of the death of older French people that runs as a really strong undercurrent.
It's hard not to think of that line from the Christmas Carol, better they die and decrease the surface population. That you Indeed. Have this kind of attitude there, that at least you said for a segment, on the one hand, you have this generous welfare state, but maybe some people slip through the cracks. People at the poor end of the wealth spectrum slip through the cracks. And a lot of these people were among the forgotten. These are the people whose apartments, whose addresses, you spent 2 years tracking down, a lot of time finding these people. When you visited these places, you discovered another aspect of the forgotten that needed more attention. That's part of the particular vertical geography of Paris. And again, people go to Paris because they love the beauty of the city. And after reading your book, I came to see it as a kind of lethal Disneyland. So at least for some, for there are some pockets, invisible pockets of poverty that you featured in your book that help account for at least for what was like close to half of the 100 people that you looked at who died. So what was it? What was it about that vertical geography that you discovered?
Yeah. Thanks for the question. So, I was a graduate student doing my dissertation work in Paris. I thought I knew what marginal housing looked like. And it was just shocking when I visited a number of these properties. These were places that were, and I would argue that, yes, certainly about half of the people whose lives and deaths I investigated lived in what I call a vertical geography of vulnerability, but nearly all of them lived in a state of what I would call marginal or precarious housing. And what I mean by that is places that are just utterly substandard, right? Places that are that present dangers to everyday life, whether they were people who were unhoused, whether they were people who were living in squats, or whether they were people who were living in rented apartments, but apartments that were really, really a kind of affront to dignity in a lot of ways. So when I described this vertical geography, one of the things I was fascinated by was the distribution of where these people died. And in the book, there's a map that shows the locations in which these forgotten people died. I forget the numbers exactly, there were like 103 of them who were buried in the cemetery. And I managed to track down, I think like 97 or something along those lines. So I tracked down almost everybody. There were some people who had died in hospitals and there was no indication of where they had actually lived. And so, there just wasn't much that I could do there. But I was really stunned to see what looks like a really remarkably even distribution of mortality throughout the city. That, you know, I had expected people to be concentrated in, for example, poorer neighborhoods, socioeconomically poorer neighborhoods. And that wasn't the case at all, right? There were people who lived in, you know, really bourgeois neighborhoods, like in the 16th or in the 6th, right down the street from the Jardin du Luxembourg, for example, one of the poshest neighborhoods in the city. But what I discovered when I actually visited these apartments was that even in remarkably posh districts in the city, there are pockets of desperate poverty. And that has in part to do with the layout of the city as it was reconstructed in the middle of the 19th century, where in order to maximize rents, as apartments were built higher and narrower, as apartment buildings, I should say, were built higher and narrower, there is this extra level of apartments that are tucked right underneath the roofs of apartment buildings. And this is what should effectively be a kind of insulating space for the rest of the buildings, but these are indeed rentable apartments. Now, they were originally intended as quarters for servants who would work in bourgeois apartments below, so domestic help, essentially. And over the years, as people can't really afford live-in help like that anymore, they've become rentable properties, often still owned by people who own the apartments on lower floors, but they are rented out often on a kind of gray market for cash, off the books, so to speak, to somewhat more marginal populations. And there are basically, as I figured out in the process of researching this book, there are basically three demographics who tend to live in these apartments. There are students who live in these apartments because they're cheap. And indeed, many grad students who come from the United States to do their dissertation work will live in one of these spaces. They are not terribly vulnerable during heat waves because they're people who can simply leave the apartment. They can go out to a movie. They can go to a grocery store and cool off in the air conditioning. They can go out to a public park and sit in some green space and get down to ground level where the temperature is a lot cooler. There are also undocumented migrants. And while undocumented migrants face extraordinary vulnerability and really precarious lives in all kinds of ways, dying from extreme heat tends not to be one of them, because undocumented migrants who live in these buildings tend to live in groups, right? They tend to live with roommates. And so there's someone there to notice if someone collapses from the heat and get medical attention. And then there's a third population that tends to live in these buildings. And those are people who have aged in isolation and in poverty. They are people who have rented these apartments. In many cases, they've never married. They've lived there for 40, 50 years and have simply aged into retirement on a very small fixed income and have aged into a kind of poverty and vulnerability in these spaces. And for them, the heat represents a real danger. As you know, if you've ever gone into your attic on a hot summer day, heat rises, right? And so these are the hottest parts of apartment buildings. They are under uninsulated zinc roofs in most cases. And so as the sun blazes down onto those rooftops, the heat is just absorbed by the space underneath. They are places that often don't have running water. Almost none of them have a toilet or a bathtub or shower. And some of them don't have running water at all. There is another photograph in the book that shows a sort of hallway cold water tap in one of the buildings where one of the people who died, whose story I investigated, lived. And she had to go down a spiral staircase, one flight of stairs, in order to fill a bucket from a cold water tap in order to gain access to water at all. And this was a woman who was 80 years old at the time she died and had suffered a broken hip. And so that staircase essentially represented a kind of death trap. So she was effectively confined in this apartment in the heat without any access to water. So you can understand that extraordinary level of vulnerability she faced. And in many other cases, they're not necessarily older people who live here, but people with disabilities who live in poverty, who are equally trapped in those buildings as a function of not being able to navigate a staircase in order to get out to cooler temperatures. And so that's what I call a kind of vertical geography of vulnerability, where even in some of the richest pockets of the city, there are these slivers of extreme poverty and extraordinary vulnerability, particularly in an extreme heat crisis.
And when you're talking to people, the neighbors or people who had businesses in the area that these the victims might have frequented, they're not paying any attention to those living conditions. They're just looking at the issues, the lifestyle of the victims. So again, it's another form of forgetting. And what I thought was fascinating is that you have one example of the mistaken Suzanne, and where you go through all of the work and effort to try to find one person, and then you realize you're. It's a different person that you've missed. This is somebody totally, but even in that case, it reveals how people remember that past.
Yeah. Thanks for bringing up that story, which is kind of an embarrassment due to my really kind of novice ethnography, right? And it also shows why you shouldn't use phone books as a source of demographic information. So there was one of these people who died. Her name was Suzanne, and she had a pretty common last name. So there were four listings in the phone book under this name. And the first one I went to, it turns out I bumped into her next door neighbor. And I said, can you tell me about Suzanne? She was in her 80s or 90s. She died during the heat wave. Can you tell me a bit of information about her? And this was a neighbor who was herself in her late 80s. I had bumped into her. She was walking her dog. And just sort of, right outside the building. And I asked if she had known this person. And she said, oh, yeah, I know that person. Did she die during the heat wave? Yeah, I guess she did die during the heat wave. And so part of this was my fault, right? I asked a leading question that really kind of pushed this woman to answer in a highly specific way. And she began telling me all about this woman and her life and the fact that she knew her. But, she did live in a life of, to some degree in isolation. It makes perfect sense that as an older, vulnerable person, she would have died during the heat wave. And so I got confirmation that, okay, this is great. I'm like, oh, excellent. Ethnography is easy, right? What are my anthropologist colleagues complaining about? And then as it turns out, when I did that sort of second level of research to try to find these forgotten victims of the heat wave, I got the acte de décès, the death notice for this person, and discovered that she had died like a year earlier, or maybe it was a year later, I forget which. But completely unrelated to the heat. right? This is somebody who died in October of, I think, a different year. So I had the wrong Suzanne, right? Completely the wrong Suzanne. But what it told me about was the kind of memory that people have of this disaster, and a kind of forgetful memory, I guess, if you could, if we want to employ that kind of paradox. So essentially, by framing the typical victim of the heat wave as an older woman who lives in somewhat kind of marginal conditions, right, in a city, I presented this Parisian who, you know, lived in a kind of poor neighborhood and was older and was a woman, to one of their neighbors as, you know, a victim of the heat wave. And they completely agreed, right? They had no problem seeing that as the case. You know, yeah, I guess that was terrible for older people. And she was an older person who died. And yeah, that must be what happened, right? And so it just showed the remarkable kind of hollowness of memory in some ways. And indeed, there's a counterpart to this, right? When I was doing the fieldwork and asked about younger people who had died, anybody who was essentially under 60 or 65 who had died, I invariably got a response that said, oh, yeah, no, that person, the heat had nothing to do with their death. They died from their addiction. They died from their alcoholism. They died from their heart condition or any other factor. And I would get a kind of grudging acknowledgement, oh, you know, the heat didn't do them any favors. It might have been one factor, but just because they died during the heat wave doesn't mean they died of the heat. And in many cases, that may be the case, right? That may be true. But it was the fact that that was invariably the response I got that told me something really extraordinary, I think, about memory and forgetting in times of disaster. That by virtue of framing the typical heat victim as an older, poor woman who lived in a city, if you presented people with anything that didn't fit that mold, that didn't fit that risk profile, you'd get a really kind of elaborate story about how the heat was, if anything, only one factor in this person's death. And really, it was everything else that led to their invariable death.
Yeah, so it's a different way. I mean, we've had I'm working on an episode in Argentina. I'm going to be releasing in about a week. And the theme there is, are there different competing memory narratives, and whichever group has the upper hand, it controls the story. But this is a different kind of idea of how one memory, kind of like an Orientalism, that just ends up gaining so much weight that it crowds out other ways of remembering the past.
I think that's exactly right.
But if you watch the French news, and especially if we watch it during the month of June, there were some heat waves in the month of June, and 2003 is a reference point. And there are immediate references to measures that have been taken since 2003. So it's not like nothing was learned. There were lessons that were taken. This is pointed out all the time if you watch the French news coverage of weather-related disasters. So what was the response of the government, and in what ways did this limited remembering shape those responses?
Yeah, great question. Thank you for that. So essentially, the construction of the disaster as a real kind of crisis of aging, crisis of poverty, and a crisis of urban spaces really shapes the response. Right. So one of the initial responses, and I have to say, these responses are not bad things. They are, however, somewhat limited in what kinds of effects they're going to have. So one of the responses is legislation in 2004 that mandates an air-conditioned space in every retirement home in the country. So every nursing home essentially has to have a cooling space. That could be a common room. That could be, you know, really anything, but it has to be a space where multiple people can be placed in order to cool. Because the way heat waves work is that, you know, our bodies are extraordinarily resilient. Just a couple hours of cooler temperatures in a given day will turn a heat wave from being lethal into being merely extremely uncomfortable. It's not going to be fun to live through it, but you will live through it, right, with just a few hours of cooling, at least for most people. And so that's a pretty good response, right? About a third of the people who died in nursing homes or died in some kind of assisted care facility. And so that's, you know, not a bad response. That's limited, but not a bad response. Another response is at the municipal level, and cities, including Paris, implemented a telephone network where you could call a certain number and register with the city if you imagined yourself as somebody who might be vulnerable to dying during a heat wave. And what would happen is whenever the temperature got above a certain threshold, say 85 degrees or something along those lines, a social worker from the city would call you twice a day to make sure you were okay. And again, in principle, that's a good idea because social contact is a real lifesaver for certain populations who are facing serious health consequences as a function of extreme heat. That leaves people who don't have a telephone out of the equation, and so that's people who don't have phones tend to be a little bit more economically and socially marginalized than people who do have phones. So you're taking an extraordinarily vulnerable population and kind of leaving them out of the equation there. It also, on a kind of rhetorical level, is going to elicit a limited response. If you think about the construction of who is a typical heatwave victim, that is an older woman who lives in desperate poverty. And a lot of people don't want to see themselves in that kind of frame. Right. We like to imagine ourselves as young and vital and resilient, as opposed to placing ourselves in the shoes of somebody who is living a life of desperate vulnerability. And so people tend not to see themselves in that position and therefore aren't going to register for a network like this. So only about 3,000 people registered with this phone network in the city of Paris. And it also led to some really kind of flawed responses, where, you know, you'd have somebody who, the social worker couldn't reach twice. And so they send the firefighters and first responders out to the apartment. And somebody will come home from the grocery store and see firefighters breaking down their door. Again, the intention was great, but the overall effects were not necessarily as great. And so that's a kind of limited response. Other kinds of responses are things that will work at scale in adapting the city to climate change, but are going to have really limited effects as summers get hotter and hotter every year. So one example is limiting surface traffic in city streets in central Paris. That's going to cut down on emissions that will have a long-term effect of climate adaptation, increasing bicycle infrastructure and pedestrian infrastructure and public transportation infrastructure. All of this, again, will reduce emissions and will therefore help to mitigate some of the worst effects of climate change. But again, these are long-term kinds of solutions. Solutions like mandating that new buildings have to have either a solar array installed on the roof or a green roof. Again, long-term kinds of solutions, but they're not going to have short-term impact on protecting really vulnerable people.
Okay. And the example that I like that I've heard you give in another presentation is of this cafe that was, where that was the bottom of the building where you lived. You noticed a particular a person that would frequent this cafe, and you suggest that, well, maybe a little bit more of this needs to happen. So could you explain that, sure. That story?
Sure. So, I don't want people to take this story as me adopting this notion that a collapse in solidarity and individualism is, and heightened individualism and entitlement is what caused the crisis. So please take this story with a grain of salt, right? This is decidedly an anecdote. So when I was doing the bulk of the fieldwork for this project in 2007, I was living in a building that had a cafe in the ground floor. And so every morning before I would set out to go to work, whether it was to an archive or whether it was to, visit some of these addresses, I would stop and get a coffee in the cafe on my way out the door. And there was a guy I noticed who would come in every morning, and he was in his 70s. And I recognized him because he had a dog he would walk. And this dog would bark constantly. And I had a one-year-old child at the time, and it woke my kid up during nap time regularly. So I had remarkable ill will toward this guy for waking up my kid. But that aside, I did see him come into this cafe every morning with his dog. And he would hand something to the bartender, and then he would bend backward over the bar. And the bartender would use these drops and put drops in this guy's eyes. And I don't know why this happened, right? Maybe it was his glaucoma medicine. Who knows what the medicine was? Maybe he just couldn't put eye drops in himself. I know some people are squeamish about that sort of thing. But what this told me was that this is a guy who didn't die during the heat wave, and he didn't die during the heat wave for a reason. He didn't die because he lived, first of all, in a walkable neighborhood that had cafes. He lived in a place where he would go to the same cafe every morning, so everybody knew he was coming. Everybody expected him. He lived in a place where there were people who cared for him enough to help him take his medicine. He had a dog, which meant that he got out of the apartment a couple of times a day at a minimum to walk the dog. All of these things were factors that boosted his resilience, right? That made him significantly less likely to die during a heat wave. Now, I had mentioned that of the forgotten victims of the heat wave, there's a remarkably even distribution through the city. That's not to say that there wasn't extraordinarily concentrated geography of mortality per arrondissement. So if you look at mortality on the whole, if you look at mortality of the 1,000 people, not the 100 people I investigated, but the 1,000 people who died during the heat wave in Paris, there are real concentrations. And those concentrations tend to be in really modern neighborhoods, like the Olympiade concentration in the 13th, or the there's a concentration of modern 70s buildings on the Seine in the 15th, right across from, right next to the Eiffel Tower, essentially, as you go from the 7th into the 15th. These were places that had extraordinarily high levels of mortality. These were complexes that were built on what had at the time been slums that were slated for redevelopment in the 60s and 70s. They are towers, essentially, high-rise buildings where there's intense heat concentration. There's very little ventilation because the windows don't open all the way in order to prevent people from falling out of them. So on health grounds, they are places that also have fractured neighborhoods. They are places that are not pedestrian friendly. They are places where, in some cases, dozens of cafes and bakeries were demolished in order to build these buildings. And so there are places where those spaces of congregation, like the cafe, which serves as a kind of informal living room for many Parisians who live in tiny apartments but get out to get into these social spaces in order to have a little bit of space, right? Or bakeries where, you know, people go to get their bread every single morning and they are expected and they're greeted by name. There are places where these public spaces of congregation have been destroyed. So that older man who lived in my neighborhood, who walked his dog to the cafe, simply wouldn't have been able to do that in a different neighborhood. So I guess what I'm arguing is not necessarily that people need, you know, more solidarity with their neighbors. That's probably true. But essentially, walkable spaces can be life-saving, right? Walkable spaces that have these social spaces for congregation can be truly life-saving. And so, this anecdote, I think, suggests that.
So if you're planning communities for the future of climate change, try to plan them in ways in which people can more easily be connected. If you got to get in your car to go everywhere, and that's one of the things that attracts me to the third chapter idea. I want to be in a place where I don't have to get in my car to go everywhere. Or I could walk downtown. I could connect more easily with people. And reading that last part or listening to your commentary on the story of the cafe, the greedy me was thinking, I wonder which places are higher in social capital. Can I crowdsource this and get reactions and which cities are more sociable than others? And I was also, lots of things went through my head. I'm thinking of a book that I just loved, Bowling Alone. And this seemed to be an echo of Robert Putnam, Harvard public policy expert, Bowling Alone, that, you know, if the U.S. has become a sicker society, if we resort to lawsuits more often, it's because we don't do things together as much. That greatest generation that came together during World War II and that fueled the Rotary Clubs, the Lions Clubs, the Bowling Leagues, the Bridge Club, that generation of people getting involved and connecting with each other has died off, and we're into a more selfish, disconnected age. I felt like I was listening to echoes of that. And that's Putnam's main point, is that the more we connect, whether it's joining a bowling league or going to church, physically, it's proven the healthier you are. And in this case, it's, well, that could save your life. If you know somebody that's looking out for that might just miss you, that could save your life.
Absolutely. And that's in part why there's such an emphasis on the crisis of isolation in the book. And I need to give credit where credit's due here, not to Putnam, although you're not wrong there at all, but to a book that I found profoundly influential as I embarked on this project. And that is Eric Kleinenberg, who's a sociologist at NYU, his book, which is called Heatwave, A Social Autopsy of Disaster in Chicago. And it's really, I think, the first kind of humanistic or qualitative social science approach to heat waves that I've been able to find in any event, where he looks at the 1995 July heat wave in Chicago, which I remember, I wasn't living in Chicago at the time, but I remember it made national news, when about 700 people die in just 3 days in Chicago. And they're people who are largely living in isolation. But one of the coolest things that he does in this book is he looks at two neighborhoods that are basically equal on the poverty scale. They're two very poor neighborhoods in Chicago. One is called North Lawndale and the other is called Little Village. They are adjacent to each other. They share demographic characteristics, right? They share really similar levels of poverty and they share a microclimate because they are literally adjacent neighborhoods. One of them is primarily Black and the other is primarily Latino. And one of the things that he discovers in doing his fieldwork for the book is that the Black neighborhood, North Lawndale, suffers an extremely high level of mortality during the heat wave. It's one of the deadliest neighborhoods in the city during the heat wave. The Latino neighborhood, Little Village, suffers very little mortality during the heat wave. There are lots of explanations for this, right? There are politicians, there are epidemiologists who look at this disparity and they make the argument that, oh, well, Latinos come from hot climates, so they are physiologically more adapted to the heat, which is just a crock, right? It's completely ahistorical. If we want to look at this, we could argue that Black Americans have roots in the tropics, right? Or they came from the American South during the Great Migration. So the idea that there's a physiological difference, a race-based physiological difference, taps into really some of the ugliest chapters of scientific racism in American history. What Kleinenberg discovers is that even though both neighborhoods have similar crime levels and similar poverty levels, there is a fear of crime in North Lawndale that doesn't exist in Little Village. Essentially, Little Village has social life on the street. People are more sociable. They get out of their apartments. They get down to street level where the temperature is still hot, but bearable. Whereas in Little Village, in North Lawndale, there are many windows that are boarded up. There are windows that are nailed shut because of fears of crime. There are windows with bars over them that simply don't open. And all of this dramatically increases people's isolation, where they're confining themselves in their apartments out of a fear of crime, in what ultimately drives them to their deaths from heat stroke. So it's not necessarily about socioeconomic status. Socioeconomic status can have a real influence on vulnerability or resilience. But in this case, it was an example of one population simply has greater levels of sociability than the other because of, kind of baked in fears in this case. And so all of this leads to far greater resilience in a population that at a glance should suffer similar levels of vulnerability.
So your observations really have larger ramifications for, this is a global, we're in the global age of climate change. You're pointing out things like how we build matters and what kind of social ties we have. That matters. There are lots of parallels you point out, too, with COVID in the U.S., the way people get forgotten in terms of the counting. The same thing happens here. And how memorialization works with the victims of the 2003 heat wave or the victims of the pandemic. So what are some of the parallels that you're finding with the COVID pandemic?
Yeah. Thanks for the question. There are some really extraordinary parallels, and some of them are fairly obvious parallels, right? COVID struck older populations much more severely than younger populations. It struck populations with pre-existing health conditions or underlying health conditions much more than people who didn't have those underlying health conditions. So the kinds of people who suffer, higher levels of mortality during both crises are really similar. On a kind of rhetorical level, this also works. And it's also in large part a function of people who suffer the greatest degree of vulnerability in both crises. They are people who we expect to die anyway, right? We expect to be likelier to die in any condition. And there are people whose deaths are, let's say, less surprising than the deaths of others might be. So if somebody in their 20s dies, that's kind of surprising if they didn't have any underlying health conditions, right? A kind of healthy person in the prime of life, their death is a kind of shock to the system. But people who are in their 80s, nobody's really surprised when they die, because they're imagined to be somewhat closer to death in any event. Likewise, people who are living in really precarious conditions, say, for example, somebody who may only be in their 40s, but they are an unhoused injecting drug user. That's somebody, you're not shocked if they wind up dying even in their 40s as a function of that kind of extraordinary vulnerability. And so I would argue that as a function of those kinds of conditions of life and ultimately conditions of death, their deaths become somewhat less memorable than deaths of than the more shocking deaths of people who die in other kinds of conditions. So essentially, I think that this leads to a kind of vast social forgetting of the significance of these kinds of mortality events, even when that mortality surrounds us. I mean, there's an exceptional number of people who died of COVID even early in the crisis. I remember in April of 2020, when the New York Times publishes that story, that front page story about 100,000 people dying from COVID, and they call it an incalculable loss. We lived in a landscape of mortality, and yet there's been a really incredibly rapid forgetting of the pandemic. Some of it is an effort to sort of turn the page, right? That it was a horrible moment to live through. It's a horrible moment to still be living through because there's still excess mortality linked to COVID. We are very much not out of the pandemic. But it's easy to understand why people want to forget and why there's been relatively little sort of social and cultural memory of the pandemic. To the extent that there are very few, for example, television shows or movies or books, novels that frame themselves around the pandemic, right? There's been an exceptional forgetting on a kind of cultural scale. And I think, it has to do in many cases with the very marginal nature and disenfranchised nature of the populations who are most vulnerable.
So if you think we can and should learn from the past, there is a lot of forgetting that's happening connected to climate change that we really need to be alert to. The way people get counted and forgotten, the way construction works and people get forgotten, the way trust works and people can get forgotten. Again, larger repercussions that we need to keep in mind.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right.
Rick, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me. Really appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a great conversation about a really haunting topic.
Richard C. Keller is the Robert Turrell Professor and Chair of Medical History and Bioethics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I've been talking with him about his book, Fatal Isolation, The Devastating Paris Heat Wave of 2003. If you've enjoyed this or other episodes of Realms of Memory, tell a friend or family member. The best endorsement is word of mouth. I'm Rick Dedarian. Thanks for listening.